Dear Instructional Designer, Episode 51. Hey everybody, and welcome back to Dear Instructional Designer, the show about the instructional design journey. I'm your host, Kristen Anthony. It's season 4 of Dear ID, where we are concentrating on the journey into freelancing as an instructional designer. This episode, I'm talking with Christy Tucker, an instructional design consultant who has made her name by thinking deeply about what good instructional design is and sharing those thoughts and her learning experiences via her blog. She's also a frequent contributor to the instructional design subreddit, which is where I met her. Today, she's going to tell us a little bit more about her journey into instructional design freelance work and how she performs that work effectively. So, let's get started. Christy, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Kristen, for having me.
So I'm really excited about this season of Dear ID because we are talking about freelancing. And I know that you've been freelancing actually for quite some time. You're like one of the people that I looked up to when I was getting started. And so I want to start out by talking about your journey to freelancedom. How did you sort of jump out there and make that transition to freelance ID?
When I was working my last full-time W-2 job, I had some freelance work that I was doing on the side. And that got me enough income, for one thing, to kind of save up some buffer. Mm-hmm. And it paid enough for me to buy myself a laptop that I could use as my work computer and to buy some software. And I didn't make a ton of, especially starting the initial project really wasn't even making money. It was literally just, can I make enough to break even on getting the computer and the software that I know I'm going to need long term? Mm-hmm. And then to make sure that I had, kind of a buffer. I was working for Cisco Systems at the time when they were, this was in 2011, when they were going through one of the first of many rounds of layoffs since then. And my contract was coming to an end. And I'd been looking for some more freelance work. I'd found a project that was going to be a big project that would be basically full-time for a couple of months. Mm-hmm. And so the timing kind of worked out nicely that my contract at Cisco was coming to an end and things seemed pretty unstable there at the time. And yet I had this freelance project that looked more stable than what my W-2 work was. So I made the leap thinking, well, maybe, if it doesn't work out, I can always go back to working in a cubicle farm. And fortunately, I have never had to go back to working in an office since then.
Awesome. So I really appreciate you sharing that particular story because I have two follow-up questions. And the first one is, I know people, when you think about freelancing, and I actually just recorded a solo episode about this, but people think about freelancing and it's scary. And I never want to downplay the risk of it, but it's scary in proportion to your full-time job, which is also scary because it's not as secure as it feels sometimes. Like it seems like when you were making that leap, you were sort of in that situation where you're like, things are sort of risky here too.
Yes. There was a great piece of wisdom from a blogger named Michelle Martin many years ago that she had pointed this out, that in terms of our retirement funds, when we save for retirement, you would never put all of your funds for your 401k or your IRA into the stock of one company. Mm-hmm. Because that's crazy risky. And yet we think it's not risky to have all of your 100% of your salary dependent on a single company. Mm-hmm. When in reality, sometimes being freelance and having income from multiple sources and multiple companies can actually be less risky than having it be, yep, 100% of my income comes from this one company. If I get laid off tomorrow, I have no income.
Right.
Whereas as a freelancer, if let's say one of my projects drops, I still have other work from another client. I've got two projects going on with two different clients. So right. I still have something coming in. I'm not going down to zero.
Right.
And so, yes, there is some risk. And I agree. I don't want to, downplay the risk. And you really can hit some feast or famine. But it is not necessarily that much riskier than W-2 work. Yeah. You know, that full-time, we think of it, we think that, you know, that you have all this job security. I think even when you're full-time, job security is kind of a myth. Mm-hmm. Your security is in, do you have the skills to go find the next thing after this one ends?
Yeah.
Because the one guarantee is that this current project that you're on, this current job, it is going to end at some point. So your security is in your skills, not in your employer. Your skills in your relationships.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Agree 100%. I mean, so given that though, how have you, because sometimes it also seems like there's a whole bunch of people who are freelance ID and a bunch of people who want to be freelance IDs. How have you positioned yourself and your expertise sort of in the marketplace? How did you choose to set yourself apart?
So for me, my niche is really in scenario-based learning and storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I have a pretty broad definition of scenarios here. And often what I end up doing for clients is really things where it's a mostly kind of traditional linear course, but we're doing some kind of mini scenarios stuck in as practice exercises somewhere in there. Because mm-hmm. Sometimes all I can get them to do is to dip their toes in the water. And that's okay. And I'm okay with that. So for me, it's been a combination of making my portfolio really all be examples for the most part that have that kind of scenario-based learning. Mm-hmm. I used to have an example that was some software training. And I actually took it out because I decided I don't actually want to do Captivate software tutorials anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to show people that that's a thing I do. Despite the fact that I do it, it's like I've done a fair amount of LMS work and Moodle work. People who know me from Cisco know that I did a lot of Moodle work there. And so mm-hmm. I get referrals sometimes for LMS work or for Moodle work because of the people who knew me there who do that. But you will find almost no mention of that in my portfolio because I don't actually want all of my work to be Moodle work. So I don't talk about it. I talk about scenarios and why we do that. My blog has a lot about scenario-based learning and storytelling. I've done now a couple of presentations for conferences and different groups on scenario-based learning. And so part of it is that this is the thing I write about and talk about. So this is the thing I get known for.
Okay.
And because that's all my examples in my portfolio, let's say a client finds me via my blog or through some referral. If they go look at my portfolio, if they're completely uninterested in the storytelling and doing scenarios, chances are they're going to look at my portfolio and they're going to decide to go hire somebody else without ever contacting me. Mm-hmm. And as far as I'm concerned, that's great. That means I never spent any time talking to somebody who's not a good fit.
Yeah.
Because I would rather filter those people out at the very beginning. If they're completely not interested in doing anything that is that kind of work that I think is the most fun and the most rewarding, that I screen them out sometimes, frankly, probably before they even talk to me.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And I've been talking about that on the show for quite some time. Is your portfolio should reflect the things that you want to do, that you want to be doing, even if you're not necessarily doing them right this second.
Correct. Yeah. Your portfolio, yes, it should show your skills, but it is definitely that pointing towards, and what do you want more of? Mm-hmm. That's what you put in your portfolio. And I have done some tweaking over the years to make it more refined and more focused on that.
That's awesome advice. That's awesome advice. So there's a network involved and B, your portfolio. And those are two things that are bringing you clients. And so I sort of want to segue into that. A lot of people think, you know, I don't have a network. Sort of speaking from my own point of view, my first conference was within this last 12 months when I paid for it myself after going freelance. So I didn't have things like that. But I still felt like and still feel like I have a network of people. So how would you say you have built a network of colleagues and potential clients? You know, how do you build those relationships, particularly since you're not working in an office anymore.
I think that's something that most of us find as a challenge when we're working independently. As much as I love working remotely, I think that that's something we all have to work with. Mm-hmm. For me, a lot of it has been because I started blogging in 2006. Mm-hmm. And so some of this for me is because I started blogging at that point. And so I built my reputation and I started blogging long before I really had intended to become freelance, mm-hmm. and to start my own business. I started blogging as a tool for my own learning.
Yeah.
But it got me to know a bunch of other bloggers. It got me to know, you know, Cami Bean and Carl Kopp and Connie Melamed and some of whom I just met for the first time at the Learning Solutions Conference in March. You know, Cami mm-hmm. Bean, I have known for 10 years and I finally got to meet her in March. It was really exciting. Yeah. So blogging has been the tool for me, but Twitter and Reddit, instruction design, that subreddit, I think there's LinkedIn groups. It has been other tools. Blogging is certainly not the only tool that you can use for that, but somewhere online, I think there's lots of places to make these somewhat loose connections online, but that is still that network out there. Mm-hmm. Specifically, more recently in the last 2 years, there's a group called the Online Network of Independent Learning Professionals. And this is a group that meets virtually every other week. We do a 1 hour Zoom call. Sometimes it's a presentation from somebody in the group or a guest speaker. It's often a community hour where people just come in and bring their questions of, okay, I'm working with a client and I've got this problem. So help me all, you know, everybody jump in and kind of brainstorm. How would you handle this? How do you handle this if a contract says this? And, mm-hmm. or how do you handle when the client wants 10 rounds of revisions? And we talk through those problems together. So we have a Slack chat where we're talking kind of during in between times and mm-hmm. then those virtual meetings. And that's been a really big community. And I actually, again, have met some of those people in person at the Learning Solutions Conference. I do think the conferences, I have finally gone in the last 2 years. I hadn't gone to one till last year mm-hmm. for ages and ages, gone to a conference because I couldn't justify the cost as a freelancer because mm-hmm. they're expensive.
Yeah.
And until I actually got a proposal accepted at the Learning Solutions Conference, I did not go. And I had a couple of failed proposals. So all of you out there who are listening and who have had failed conference proposals, just keep trying. You know, go follow the advice. Don't feel bad that you get rejected because they get so many good ones. So, but really, it was worth the time to try to do that. And I think that's been good too. And I have certainly had some people who I've met at the conferences, not just the people who I knew online through Twitter and blog, but who I met specifically there, who then I've been able to keep in touch with. And that's another great place to get both re-energized and to make new connections.
Awesome. Awesome. And I went to Torrance Learning's download and NXAPI party last May, and I'm about to go to Learning Dev Camp. So I like your approach. So here's something I've been struggling with, Christy, is that it's a sort of noise to work ratio. Like, so my first 9 months of freelancing was just, it was hell. I was working way too much and I hadn't priced myself right. And so it was crazy. And then I found for a series of months that I was completely burnt out. I had no interest in doing anything. And now I feel like I'm back, but I'm very careful about too much noise, like with social media and particularly Slack. Like, I love Slack, but it just kills me sometimes. There's too much. How do you deal with that? Because it's what it sounds like you're saying, and I agree with, is that you need to make time for these online spaces because they can really give you really good connections and build solid relationships, not only with potential clients, but with colleagues. But at the same time, it just seems like there's a point at which it's too much.
I think that part of it is that balance is always going to be somewhat of a moving target. Mm-hmm. That when you're first starting out, you probably are going to be spending more time on that building your business, building your reputation, building your online presence, building your connections, building those relationships, than as you get your business up and running. Mm-hmm. So part of it for me is that I do track all of my time. I have a spreadsheet. I know there's several time tracking tools you can use, but I just use a spreadsheet and I track all of that unbillable time. So I can see, well, how much time am I spending on my blog? How much time am I spending on LinkedIn or in Slack or whatever? Mm-hmm. Because to some extent, it's also having those numbers so that I can see, wow, I spent 15 hours in Slack last month. I love Slack, but I'm not sure I'm getting 15 hours worth of value out of that,
Yeah.
So there's that. For blogging, I have a specific time blocked on my calendar of this is when I'm going to work on writing blog posts. Mm-hmm. Now, during the week, there's always a bit more of as comments come in, I don't want to let those sit too long. And I do responses and I reply to emails and comments throughout the week. But I have a block of time that I dedicate to my blog. Mm-hmm. In terms of Slack and LinkedIn and Reddit and other things, I tend to do those tasks as the transition between other tasks. So like right now I've got two big projects that I'm working on. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm kind of mentally switching gears between, okay, I'm doing this project where I'm storyboarding this soft skills thing and I kind of need to mentally switch gears. Okay, so I'm going to go check Twitter for a minute, go check if there's any new questions in Reddit, moderate my LinkedIn group and zap some spam. Okay, now I've taken 20 minutes to do all of those things and now I'm going to go back and switch over to this more technical training on this other project.
Okay.
So I use it as the mental break in between. The other thing is that I do a lot of trying to reuse content. So the questions that I answer on Reddit or LinkedIn or Slack or email or eLearning Heroes then can prompt blog posts, mm-hmm. including in some respects, in some cases, literally I'm copying and pasting. If I've written two paragraphs to somebody on Reddit, which is pretty easy to do, that's half a blog post already written. So I'm recycling some of that content too.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So we've been talking about just sort of the general approach to freelance, but I know that some of the other questions that people tend to have are more business technical, if you will. And so if you're okay with it, could you tell us a little bit about the structure of your business and why you went with that? And by structure, I mean things like, are you still a sole proprietor or did you form an LLC or did you maybe start with one type of business and then change as you grew?
So I have an LLC that was based on advice with a friend who's an attorney mm-hmm. who said, set up a separate business checking account and set up an LLC because you need that protection. Mm-hmm. I did also meet with a CPA when I was starting things out to kind of talk through things and to have him help me walk through the figuring out whether I should be an LLC or an S corp. Mm-hmm. And the answer to that question is you need to go talk to an accountant and figure it out.
Okay.
because the S corp is a more complicated, the short answer on an S corp is that one, your business is making consistently more money than and by a good chunk more money than what you'd be making salaried, then you're probably better off converting to an S corp. Mm-hmm. But if you're making about the same or less, which mostly I think starting out, many of us are probably making, kind of comparable. Mm-hmm. It's a lot. An S corp's a lot of extra paperwork. So that's kind of it for me is having that separation between my personal and my professional. I can do that with an LLC. It's still a sole proprietor. So in terms of taxes, it's all pass-through income. But I still also want to have that separate tax ID so that my Social Security number is not floating around with every different company I work for. I have a company tax ID.
I mean, so speaking of CPAs, how do you make tax time easier on yourself?
I use a free accounting program called Wave, like Wave Hello.
Okay.
That's how I track my expenses and categorize everything as it comes in.
Okay.
You can link it to your checking account. So then it just imports everything automatically, and then you just have to categorize it.
Okay.
And so that's part of it, is that I have a reminder set up on my to-do list that every other week I just go in and I go in and categorize those transactions and make sure that I've got syncing up receipts with the transactions for things where I've got receipts. And I do my own taxes. I do not actually pay for a CPA to do them, because I find that with the tax software walking me through it, that I can just do it myself. Now, if I get to the point where I'm going to do an S corp at some point down the road, that will be the point where I definitely will have to pay somebody else to do it, because somebody who knows how to maximize the taxes, that's really worth it. Mm-hmm. And if you find that you are doing lots of subcontracting and having other subcontractors, that's also one of those points where you should definitely hire somebody else to do that for you, because one of the people I've talked with has said that what she pays for the accountant, now that she's got two or three employees and multiple subcontractors, what she pays for the accountant is probably five times less than what that accountant saves her on taxes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. That's a very helpful sort of milestones for when to go get
help. When do you need to do it? I think everybody should try to talk to an attorney and a CPA at the beginning of getting it started, so that you kind of set things up the way that you should. And, you know, it's worth paying for 1 hour of those people's time. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, I think if you're a sole proprietor, because really, okay, we all work from home. Mm-hmm. You've got the cost of a laptop or a computer, maybe a couple of other devices, and you've got software and, you know, some subscriptions of things. You can buy books. You might pay for travel to a conference. It's not that hard. A Schedule a C is not actually that hard. We mm-hmm. all are pretty technical people. I think most of us could handle this.
I mean, so let's talk about expenses, because golly gosh, wow. So, you know, you talked about how you've been very careful about conferences because they're really expensive. What else do you find is sort of worth paying for? As part of your toolkit that you have, you must have.
So you need a good computer. You either need a decent laptop or a decent computer, and that a lighter weight laptop for travel, depending on how much travel you do. You have to pay for whichever development software you're doing. Mm-hmm. I currently have licenses for both Captivate and Storyline. I actually did the Storyline 3 initially because I wasn't doing that much development. And then a couple of projects have come in, and so I'm going to do the 360 annual subscription instead of doing the perpetual license, because I think I've hit that tipping point for me. And again, you know, it's all shifting target of like, how much work are you doing? I had a couple of years where I was doing tons of storyboarding. I was doing more subcontracting work where I was just doing storyboarding and not really doing much development. And it's really hard to justify the cost of that $1,000 a year mm-hmm. if you're not really doing that much work.
And you know, that's a really good point, because sometimes it feels like, oh, I started a subscription, I have to keep it going forever. But like, if you have a year where, I don't know, maybe you haven't planned a whole bunch of course development or not a whole bunch of course development with that tool, you could maybe let it lapse and then pick it up again when you need it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for me, I did end up hitting like 2 years where I really wasn't doing very much development work. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of how it worked out for me. Mm-hmm. For other tools, I pay for extra storage on both Google Drive and Dropbox mm-hmm. because I have clients who use both, and I would rather just use the tool that they're familiar with. Mm-hmm. I pay for Zoom for video conferencing because I find the platform has been really stable for me and works well. I've been paying for, I pay for some, you know, stock image things depending on what, you know, again, kind of depends on how much development work you're doing. but I pay for some of those things. General liability insurance, your professional liability insurance, that is also a thing that is worth paying for.
Okay.
If part of it, no, for me, I pretty early on had a couple of clients who required liability insurance, so that prompted me to get it.
Okay.
Pretty quickly. But I do recommend it. Again, it's one more layer of protection for your personal assets. That if I can't think of a single instructional design or e-learning business that I know that has gotten sued for anything, but if somehow it happened, having that insurance policy means they're going after your corporate insurance policy instead of your house.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so I have that insurance policy, which I got through Hiscox, through the Freelancers Union. If you're looking for insurance things, I will say that not that you shouldn't do your comparison shopping with other things, but the Freelancers Union has resources for insurance things. So I do pay for it. That's where I found, I had been through a different company previously, and after they increased my rates again, I decided I should probably go check that. And sure enough, it's about half the cost when I switched plans.
Nice.
So it's not anywhere near what I used to be paying. I use HelloSign for signing contracts, and I'm on the free plan for that, but I could see if you were doing a lot of contracts. I do know some people who pay for that one, and that seems to be worth it, potentially. I mean, I am definitely big on use the free plans or the free levels of tools for as long as possible until I get to a point where I really can't. Oh, I pay for the hosting of my company website and portfolio. Mm-hmm. That's one of the other things I pay for.
Okay. So that's a really good list. And thank you so much for bringing up the insurance, because I know somebody asked specifically about that, and that is just a thing that I have no knowledge of. Again, I want to emphasize that it's there are probably some things that everybody needs, like the computer and your development software, but you can think about those things, some of them anyway, in terms of sort of what's the kind of work that I'm getting right now. Like, it doesn't have to be a forever thing all the time. Yeah. And that's really helpful to think about.
Absolutely. And again, the what's the right mix at any given time is going to potentially change. And you often can start out on the free plans. I started on the free plan for Zoom, and then I switched to paying for it when I felt like I was getting enough out of it. There's no shame in using those free tools for as long as possible. And sometimes the free tool might be enough.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the elephant in the room, if you will, contract negotiations and pricing. Now, I know we can't get too detailed on this, but just sort of generally, how do you handle contract negotiations, and what are your considerations when you're sort of handling that along with pricing? Because those two things, at least in my mind, go together. You know, I'm negotiating this contract with you, and I'm also thinking about my pricing strategy with you. So how do you deal with that?
So I think I'm going to actually back up in the process just a little bit from that and talk about client screening.
Okay.
Because I think that that's also part of this process.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So for me, most of the time when a client contacts me, they will fill out the contact form on my website, or I'll get an email via referral. Mm-hmm. I have a list of questions that I send back to ask. And one of those questions is a question about budget, which is your budget, you know, do you have a budget set aside for this project? Is that budget at least X dollars? I change the X dollars amount somewhat based on kind of if they've given me kind of a 2-sentence description of things. If somebody says they need a 5-minute quick tutorial, the what X is a smaller number than I have 8 modules and for 4 hours total content.
Right.
X is a larger number. So I tweak that a little bit.
Do you also think about sort of the kind of client, like a nonprofit versus a corporation?
There is probably some of that, because I don't necessarily want to completely scare them off so that we have no conversations. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I do want that number to be big enough that the people who want you know, 500 hours of work done for $150, mm-hmm. that they will simply not contact me again. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That they will filter themselves out. And there is, to some extent, in that client screening, I kind of want to filter out the people who don't have a budget. So I want them out of the process pretty quickly. My goal is to not spend very much time. You can spend, because I think this is also into that, you know, how much time do you spend on things? You can spend lots and lots of time doing proposals and talking to prospective clients. And, you know, if you're, you know, there's always that question, well, how many clients do you talk to before you actually close one deal? Mm-hmm. And most of us are probably, you're closing 1 in 4, 1 in 3. Those are the numbers I often hear from people. Okay. And that's probably typical for my stuff too, is I at least get contacted by a couple of people who, you know, it doesn't end up panning out. And you want to cut down on how much time. You really don't want to spend 15 hours for each one of those extra three that's never going anywhere. Mm-hmm. As much as possible, you want them screened out of the process quickly, or you want to get them converted to something paid. So one of the strategies that I've been using is that instead of trying to give them a full price estimate, instead of trying to do all of that scoping right at the beginning and spend all that time going back and forth and figuring out the scope and getting it narrowed down, I do a paid road mapping session. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the first thing. So I send those client screening questions, which is kind of a, tell me the project, what's the goals, what's the problem we're trying to solve? Do you have a budget? I also ask have you worked with instructional designers before? Is this a new type of project to your organization? Mm-hmm. And a question about who's the other stakeholders on this? And is there anybody else we should be inviting to the initial consult? Partly because I also want to know, is this a project where there are 15 stakeholders who all have to sign off on this?
Right.
Because I want to know that early in the process. Personally, no, like I'll do those projects. I know that there are people who just simply won't do those, but I'll do them. I'm just going to adjust my price accordingly. If legal has to review it 3 different times, the price is going up accordingly. Mm-hmm. So I have those questions, and then we do a call and I talk about this paid road mapping that, you know, here's the plan, here's the scope. I give them a couple of options of, okay, well, we can do kind of this high end level thing and I can do that lower end thing. And some of that is that then I'm getting paid for my time writing my proposal. Mm-hmm. That time doing analysis, and I can do better analysis because I'm not trying to minimize how much unpaid work I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I can do, you know, I had a client earlier this year I did one of these roadmaps for, and I talked to four of his current clients. I did phone interviews with four of the different clients that he's already got to find out what's working and what's not in their current stuff, which is a great thing in terms of analysis, but a step that, frankly, if I was doing it unpaid, there is no way I would have made all those phone calls because it's just too much time.
Yeah.
So I can do a better analysis. And so I'm kind of doing the analysis phase as a paid separate project. But that gives them a small amount. The risk for a client is much lower because it's a small fixed price thing. You weed out the folks who have no money. If their whole budget is only, you know, $500, then you've already kind of weeded them out with the initial project because they don't have the money to do even the initial thing. Then they probably don't have the money to do the 20K worth of work. That's what they're really looking for. Mm-hmm. But you also get to work with them for a little while. You build up trust and you find out whether your work styles are compatible.
Right.
Because you also, as a freelancer, as a consultant, have the ability to say no. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Then both sides have learned that early on in a pretty low risk situation.
Yeah.
So I'm moving more to road mapping. It's not 100%, but I'm trying to do some more of that. I am also trying to move to more fixed price for projects. Again, reduces the risk for clients in terms of they know exactly what that budget's going to be. Mm-hmm. Fixed price does mean that you have to really know the scope and you have to have it really clearly written down. Mm-hmm. And you have to have specified in the contract, you know, it's especially revisions, because I think revisions are the place where projects get derailed.
Yeah.
And your time gets off. And so it's taken me a while to kind of go through all of that to figure out for myself of how I say, okay, well, you know, at the storyboarding stage, you can change any of the content that you want. And we're going to do two rounds of review on this. And then once you've approved it, we're not changing the content anymore mm-hmm. when we get into the development. Or depending on what the client is, of like, okay, well, after, you know, at the alpha stage, that you can change up to 5% of the content. And I've got kind of a limit on like how much you can change that, because if it requires voiceover re-records, I need to have a fairly firm limit on how much I'm going to be paying a voiceover person to do pickups. Mm-hmm. So I do try to do more of that. Being able to do fixed price, it's much harder to do fixed price when you're first getting started. Mm-hmm. When you first get started, it is much easier to do hourly mm-hmm. because you have to be able to predict how much time things are going to take you. So if you're first getting started, I will say do hourly, set yourself some hourly rate. A good rule of thumb is whatever your W-2 full-time rate was, double that. And that's probably about what your freelance rate should be, give or take. There's a couple of resources. I've got a blog post with some other benchmarks for things, but that's a good starting point. And then track all of your time. Get yourself a spreadsheet or a time tracking tool or something and track the time it takes for you to do different projects. And then after you've been doing it for a year, you have a bunch of data on, oh, well, when I did this 30-minute course, it took me this long to do the storyboarding and it took me this long to do the development. So now if somebody else asks me for a 30-minute course, I have a benchmark of my own personal stuff mm-hmm. to figure out how long that's going to take so that then I can estimate it. For me, fixed price ends up working out better, especially if I'm doing writing and storyboarding, because I'm a really fast writer.
Okay.
And if I'm getting paid by the hour, I get penalized for writing fast.
Right. Yes.
And I'm tired of being penalized for writing quickly, for being efficient, mm-hmm. for being productive. And so that's part of why I'm moving more to being more of that fixed price. So I think that all of that is kind of part of it. And I always aim in my agreements to have expectations really clearly set. My scope of work documents list out both my responsibilities and what I'm going to deliver, but also list out these are the responsibilities of the client. Mm-hmm. So that's part of it too, is to specify for them so that the expectations are really clear on both sides what it is.
That's awesome. And yeah, just thank you for that detailed advice. I know I'm only like a little over a year into it, and I know I've grown a ton, particularly in my ability to communicate, I think, clearly and honestly with clients, and my ability to say, Kristen, this is the type of work you want to do. As we begin to wrap up here, given all that you've experienced on your journey thus far, and the things that we've talked about, what would you say would be some of the skills that you would think were necessary to successfully running your own business that are sort of on top of or outside of what your typical instructional designer at a full-time job might have right now?
So there's definitely that piece of the estimating and negotiating that, while you have probably some of that, especially time estimates you might have in your current job, so much more of it because there's nobody else to kind of help you. It's all on you. So I think that's definitely a piece of it. Really project managing yourself. Again, I think lots of instructional designers already do that, but even more so. There's that whole business development side. You know, when you're freelance, you should never be planning when you're freelance that you're going to do 40 hours a week of instructional design or of e-learning development. The reality is that you're probably spending, you know, approximately one day a week basically building your business, doing the social media, doing the proposals for clients, doing the relationship building, mm-hmm. and all of those other things. So you need to have those skills even more of relationship building and of building the connections and keeping in touch with people and being helpful to people in the community. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of my a lot of how clients find me is because I have been helpful through my blog or through LinkedIn or whatever online source, is that people find me because I've been helpful online. Mm-hmm. And being nice to other people does in fact get you work.
Yes, it
really does. It is that thing of when people see you as a helpful person who is an expert and is generous with their time, that it really does lead to work.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that putting yourself out there, the other big thing, is the ability to say no. You know, you talked about figuring out for yourself what kind of work you like to do and what you want to be doing. And that means saying no to the people who aren't your cup of tea.
Yeah.
You don't need to feel like you can compete, like you should compete on price with the lowest common denominator. Don't do that. Be you and charge what you're worth. Believe in, you know, you've got to believe that you are worth paying the real rates. And I think that confidence is also part of what you need.
That is very, very awesome. Man, I wish we'd had this interview about a year and a half ago.
But it'll go out there now and somebody else is going to be listening and they're going to be at the beginning of the journey at that place where you were a year and a half ago. And be able to hopefully learn from some of the things that we've done wrong. Underestimating how much time it would take to do revisions and saying yes to clients who we should have said no to. And so then somebody else out there will hopefully learn from our mistakes.
Yes, absolutely. And, I think they will. And I'm very, very grateful to have you on the show. You're my first guest of the season. So I really think people will take a lot away from this.
That's great. I'm really excited to see how this season shapes up for you with the other guests you're going to have on.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. So last three questions as we wrap up, just sort of as a quick take, what would be your sort of number one advice for someone interested in freelancing to get started?
If you don't have an online portfolio yet, you got to get one.
Yeah, boy. All right. What is your favorite thing about freelancing?
I love the variety. I love always having something new to learn. I love how I've done all sorts of different stuff. Bulldozer safety and baby behavior and how to influence people and sales training and food safety and technology training and sales training. And it's great. So there's always something new to learn.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's fantastic for me.
Awesome sauce. Last but not least, Christy, where can people catch up with you?
My company is Syniad Learning, SYNIAD Learning. My blog is at christytucker.wordpress.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Christy A. Tucker.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
This was an awesome interview with Christy. As someone who is much more experienced than I am, both in instructional design and as a freelancer, it was amazing to see where our ideas meshed and also where she had some new things to offer. One of the things we've discussed on this show is trying to move towards the kind of work you want to be doing. Christy not only reiterated the importance of crafting a portfolio that demonstrates this, but also shared methods on creating an introductory communication framework for herself to help her filter her clients, and the idea of doing a paid road mapping session with clients. I think I first heard about that from the OnLip, that is the online network of independent learning professionals that Christy talked about, and possibly Aunt Pew, but I didn't implement it. So that's something that I'm definitely going to take away from this conversation. She also gave great advice about making sure that you meet with a lawyer and a CPA when you want to set up your business, things that I have not done yet. So it was great to hear that kind of advice. And she gave general advice about client negotiations and pricing structures. So it's really just an entire truckload of wonderful advice for anyone starting out. I really hope that anyone out there who is either getting started or who, like me, are looking for ways to get on a sustainable track for business success finds this interview helpful. Please be sure to thank Christy. You can reach out to her on Twitter. She's at Christy A. Tucker, or read up on her latest at her blog, christytucker.wordpress.com. Last but not least, don't forget to leave a review on iTunes. Your review helps other people find the show and lets me know how I'm doing. Thanks so much for listening, and take care.